Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. My guest today is Colm Tobin, and his new book is Nora Webster. It's published by Scribner's. And he just said to me something so interesting. You said of this book that this is a book that only five people would want to read. Now, why would you say that?
It's a widow in a provincial place in Ireland, and nothing happens to her over 3 years except things that are imperceptible to her and maybe noticed by the reader, but not much. So if you ask, well, does she get married again? Does she run away? Does her house go on fire? Does she win the lottery? Does she suddenly have a moment of absolute, you know, breakdown? No, none of those things happens. And so novels like that are very vulnerable because people really do want to know that their time reading the novel will not be entirely wasted.
Now, the novel, I think, begins proper on its dedication page. Would you read it, please?
Breed Tobin, 1921 to 2000. Niall Tobin, 1959 to 2004.
So this is a book about the death of your mother and your brother, am I right?
It was begun before my mother died, but that was just the first chapter, and I never really knew what to do with that chapter. But I suppose in the years after my brother died, I realized that those years we spent in that house after my father died, when I was 12 and my brother was 8, my mother was 46, and the three of us were there for 2 or 3 years with nobody else in the house, watching each other, circling each other, that I was the only one left now. And I was in a strange position because I'd spent maybe 20, 30 years creating metaphors for what happened. That no matter what book I would write, this would come into it. And that maybe if I wrote it down rather than went sideways, maybe if I actually recreated it, trusted it, went with it, almost as a way of recording it since no one else ever would, and since there would be no one else to remember it, then this would have to be a novel, because a memoir, I wouldn't know whose point of view to take. I certainly couldn't have taken my own as a 12-year-old. So I would hand it to her, because we watched her more than we watched ourselves, my mother. And I would need also to add things that didn't happen in order to make the novel, to give it a sort of texture, but also to put in things exactly as they occurred on the day, down to the tiniest moment, because if I didn't, no one else would.
Yes, and indeed, Paul Valéry, I think it is, said, God made the universe out of nothing, but he let the nothing show through. And this is a novel made out of nothings that show the beautiful, strange, empty nothingness out of which life is constructed. We all live in the midst of these nothings, yes?
Yes, it isn't a coincidence that Donal, who's a 12-year-old here, is a photographer, and that it is almost as though years later he has come back into that house with his camera and moved around the rooms of it. Very small, I mean, semi-detached house in the outskirts of a town, and just simply taken grainy black and white photographs and then let them fade or smudge them or had strange shadows where it looks as though someone is about to come into the room.
He's one of the two boys. There are four children in the family, two older sisters, two younger brothers, and Donald is the strangest of all, in a way, because when he takes photographs of things too close to know what they are, or he takes pictures of the television set. And it's so interesting because all through the novel, the reader is falling for the idea, or let me put it bluntly, this reader, Michael, I was thinking he's going to be discovered. His special sensibility is going to be discovered as a new school of Irish photography. And instead, what happens is what happens to most people. He grows up, and he's not discovered. Whatever happens is what happens. His younger brother starts taking photographs, too. Donald has a stutter, and he has it when he gets back from his mother's aunt's house. She's been taking care of the children.
Well, the father becomes ill, and it's clear he's dying. And the mother has a choice because the hospital is 2 hours away from the town where they live. And the husband wants her to be with him. And what she does is she goes to Dublin and stays with her husband, leaving her two sons with an aunt of hers. You must remember, you know, this time in the late 1960s in Ireland, the telephone, we didn't have a telephone in our house, say. The use of the telephone was not, people didn't use telephones perhaps as they did in the United States.
No, and, but long distance.
Yeah, long
Certainly
distance.
Certainly not but, long
but,
distance.
But in any case, she doesn't phone and she doesn't get in touch. She simply devotes herself to her husband. And then, of course, when she comes home after 2 or 3 months, her husband dead, to find the two boys, she finds them strange. She finds them estranged. She finds them that they don't trust her. Everything has changed with them. And she blames her aunt.
Nora, the mother, rolls up her sleeve and says, I must go to my aunt's house and find out what she did to them there. My son is stuttering. What did
But it's
Aunt
more
Josie
than that.
Do?
It's more than that because the aunt comes to visit and she notices how nervous the boys are when they see the aunt. And then one of them, Donald, has a nightmare that night. And she, one boy says, when she says, Donald, you're all right, the other boy, the 8-year-old, looks at her and says, he's not all right. And for some reason, she just thinks, well, I am going to confront my aunt to know what happened to my sons when they stayed with you. And the aunt is in her garden. She's a retired teacher. She's reading Thomas Merton. She's reading Teilhard de Chardin. She has made this beautiful space for her retirement. She's another widow but she almost seems to have benefited from it. Just turns on her and says, you have the idea of you coming out here and accusing me of something when you left your two sons, these two strange boys, with me.
All alone.
While
their father was dying, and you didn't even call, you didn't come to visit,
yeah.
You didn't say a word. What were they to think? And what was I to tell them?
And the reader now is entitled to feel that Nora is some sort of witch. You know, that Nora is, this word mother, which is such an important word now in our lexicon, that Nora is a negligent mother. And the rest of the novel will be spent attempting to refine that idea, dramatize it, work with it, turn it upside down or on its side to see what we can do with it.
Yes, and it's very interesting because it's as if Nora Webster, the title character in Colm Tobin's novel, Nora Webster, it's as if she's waking up from a deep sleep, which is the sleep of mourning. And gradually, only very gradually, will she come back to life. And so she doesn't understand that she's taken her sons and put them in a situation where they can never trust again that she won't leave. And any time she leaves them anywhere, even in their sister's care for an afternoon, well, when will she be back? When will we see our home again? And what will be the consequence of this leaving? It's really almost mythological, yes?
Yes, I suppose there are elements of that where while it is very emphatically set in a small town in Ireland in these years, I suppose I am alert to the idea that it could have wider implications, that it has a sort of resonance about, you know, that whole idea, for example, in the folk tale of children being handed, you know, from their natural parents into an environment which is not naturally theirs, and what happens to the dark thing that happens to them there, so that when they return, they are almost changelings.
And this is not a spoiler, I promise, because a book tells you everything that will happen in it by its 15th page, a serious book, a good book. Everything is always there. What we find after all of this careful accumulation of silent detail is that a ghost appears within the last section of the novel. So real to Nora, who does not believe in ghosts.
And she may be asleep, in fact. It may be someone has come. It may be that he has come in her sleep. It's unclear. I mean, in other words, there is a rational explanation for it, that she fell into such a deep sleep. But he came to her nonetheless.
And she will swear to her aunt, to her daughters, I saw Morris, that's her husband. He was with me, and he is in the room with me, and maybe he'll come back. He came. And this is everything that the novel has been forestalling. That she wants him, that there is no one else, because of all the strange things in the world, she had a happy marriage. Yes?
Yes. Oh, yes.
And they're next to impossible to describe.
Yes, so that it's important that there isn't a flashback into that marriage, that you just realize that what the grief she's suffering from is the grief of being alone in bed at night without the person she loved beside her, and that that is sort of basic to her body almost, and that she lives with that. And even though there are moments when she remembers things about Morris, where he, for example, he didn't like music, and himself and his brother would make jokes about classical music. But the music becomes magic. The Archduke Trio, which has an extraordinary sort of ghostly thing of bringing in a melody, holding it back, bringing it in, suggesting it, letting it come for a second more, bringing it back a second more. And that begins to take on magical proportions, magical aura for her. She puts it on the record player, and every time she does, something happens. But this time, of course, because she hasn't been sleeping, and that she has really at the end of her tether now, and she puts on the music, and she's alone in the house. And of course, he has to come. And it may be that she falls into the deepest place in herself, and he comes there. So the ghost part, I mean, it has to have a rational, I think, credible explanation in that it may come just then, but it comes in such detail, in such close detail, as he speaks in the room, his voice, exactly his smile. And when I'm writing that, I have a number of things on the table beside me. I have Hamlet, obviously. I have King Lear, because I have the moment when Lear comes in with Cordelia at the end of Lear, and she's dead and he's holding her, and he's wondering, is it anything? Could she stay, you know, stay? But so when she says stay a while, that's very close to a line from Lear. And then there are two, I think, lines that are close to Little Gidding, when Elliot is up all night. The war is going on. The air raids are going on in London. And as he comes home in the dawn, he sees a figure with downturned face. And Morris mentions downturned face, which may be Yeats, maybe Dante, maybe the entire business of the past in poetry that has haunted him. And so those three books are on the table, but what's outside is the place. I mean, this is being written in Wexford, very close to the house we stayed in every summer, very close to the house where my mother would never go back to again after my father died, with the sea outside, with that sea that we were in, that we spent our childhoods in. It, you know, and I knew, I was going to write it the night before on a Friday night. And I thought, no, don't do that. Just listen to some music and go to bed early and get up very early on Saturday and do it on Saturday, you know, up early. Don't make this into an, because the night you can take risks that are foolish. In the morning, you tend to be colder with yourself. And so I worked all day on it, realizing that I couldn't rewrite it, that it could only come once, that if you didn't get it right the first time, you would lose it. You could change words later, you could cut a line later, but the tone of it could not be got a second time. And I did it, knowing that when I was finished, I would go down and I would be able to go out into the sea, you know, alone, and swim for as long as I wanted.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with Colm Tobin about his book, Nora Webster. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Colm Tobin about his new book, Nora Webster, from Scribner's, the story of a woman who finds herself setting aside motherhood to grapple with grief. Now, as a background, the Troubles are occurring, and they're reported on television. There's almost like a Greek chorus telling us, oh, Northern Ireland, oh, the moon, stepping onto the moon the first time. How does the setting of this particular family in County Wexford fit into these global events?
It's almost needed for depth of field, as in a painting, but the painting is of a face. So that the trouble painters always have when they do a face is what to put in the background if you just do mere shadow. Or if, like painters of the Renaissance, you paint a hill town with some castles, but they hardly matter. And so to some extent, they hardly matter. To another extent, it's very important that this is the year 68, 69, 70, where things are beginning to change, where a woman's life in any town in Europe has new possibilities and new openings, which will affect everything about her, including the growth of her sensibility, a sort of independence of mind emerging, almost as though She's a feminist avant la lettre, meaning that the word means nothing to her.
We are given access to Nora the first time she dyes her hair. And the packets of dye are new. Even the hairdresser is using them for the first time. But she says, next time we may try some highlights. And Nora says, oh, I would never try highlights. But before long, coppery highlights are being introduced. And it's as if she knows this is a truth about fiction. The detail, the highlight, has to be there. that you can't just dye your hair. You have to dye it with all of the detail that life requires for it to seem real.
Yes, there are two elements there. I mean, one is, I suppose, that the town itself is almost like a prison. And, or it's certainly a valley of the squinting windows, you know, where everyone's watching. But at the same time, she herself has these needs, and every other woman almost does too, that things really are changing. But with her, of course, it has to be personal. And so she'll go a certain distance. She's funny. She goes a certain distance, but she won't go the whole distance with many things. I mean, with her emotions, for example, she won't allow highlights in, but she will dye her hair, as it were, emotionally. That she's not someone who's ever going to open herself up to the world in full, but privately, in some shadowy version of herself, she would allow that to happen.
And the whole end of the novel is about the musical orchestration, instrumentation of someone. It's a kind of noctambulism, you know, a sleepwalking orchestrated by musical sound or the sound of her dream, something other than the pure factuality of this is here, that is there, enters the novel and is borne to its end by music.
Brahms' German Requiem becomes an important element in the novel, even though she doesn't actually sing it in the novel. The end of the novel was always going to be her coming into the room and saying to the son, to the younger son, I'm going to sing in Brahms' German Requiem. They've let me into the choir and I'm going to sing that. Now, in order to get to there, I had to ban, I'm not making this up, Brahms' German Requiem from my house for a good decade.
Really?
So that I didn't listen to it, but I kept collecting new versions of it. I mean, there are about 20 good versions of it on CD, and I had them in the room piled up like that. I went then to London, where there was a free-for-all, where if you paid £25, you could sing in the German Requiem, starting at 11 in the morning on a Sunday. You would do rehearsals all day. And I did this with two friends, and I joined the choir, and I went through the rehearsals all day, which was to be the aftermath of my own book. And we, you know, they gave us the sheet music. We had two pianos, two professional singers on the stage, but we were an amateur choir to be trained on the day. And then at 7 o'clock, we did a performance of the German Requiem. So some of the things I did because I wouldn't get this again, but also that emotion moving towards the end of the book, that somehow or other, the aftermath of the book has to be in, I have to know it so well. I have to live it, be with it. And but even last night, I put on the opening of the German Requiem that I'm still living with. And of course, then the issue of what the ex-nun who's been in France, because she tells her that, and this is completely invented, that in a convent which had been destroyed or taken over by the Nazis, then it was given back to the nuns in 1947, and the Reverend Mother decided that in France they would get the local people together and they would get a choir, and the first thing they would sing would be the German Requiem. And the people in the village say, we can't sing in German. The German language will never be sung again in our village. You know, we will not sing German. And she says, we must do this.
It's the spirit of forgiveness.
Yes. And then she goes to the man whose sons have all been killed in the war to say, you're the great singer, will you come? And he says, no. And the reader must think, oh, well, he must come eventually. No, he doesn't. He doesn't come. But they sing the German Requiem. And that, for me, you know, was some also political idea, that out of this arose what we're also moving towards as this book comes to an end, which is Ireland joining the European Union, which is that idea of what Europe will become in the aftermath of the Second World War and with Ireland beginning to join. But that's in the background. But the emotion of the thing has to be that somehow or other it's the music that will do the lifting. Let the music do the lifting, but make the music real. In other words, there's no point in every piece of music that's mentioned here means a great deal to me. It has enormous personal, you know, that if you knew me, you'd think, oh my God, he's put in Schubert's song, Andy Music. He's had Kathleen Ferrier singing it, you know. And you would know that at 18, you know, that I was listening, you know. That. So in other words, all of the music matters. I didn't, for example, have to Google anything or ask anybody. I put in things that mattered.
Well, the quality of things that matter is on as if it were a weight. You know, the scales of justice, things that matter on the one side and the nothing on the other. And in this novel, it apparently is about nothing, but the things that matter rule in the end.
Yes, that, in other words, the theory of this would be that if you put in enough detail, but not too much detail, and you get the detail right, and you concentrate like Cézanne concentrated on the brush strokes being the right brush strokes and tonally different each one, then you will get something, or at least the reader will. And the reader will actually enter into the spirit of Nora Webster and almost become her mysteriously and over time. And it will take a particular maybe sort of reader for this to happen. But my idea is it should happen with everybody. And then you're actually living in someone else's life.
I've been talking with Colm Tobin, author of Nora Webster, published by Scribner. Thank you, Colm, for joining me.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Nora Webster at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Lydia Millett is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.